as we get our local view on a Tuesday to get the show started. He's the fine columnist for the Register Guard. You could catch his work on the cover of the sports section online, registerguard.com, on Twitter, at austinmeek.com. Austin, a good Tuesday to you, sir. How are things?
Hey, Steve. I'm doing good. How are you?
Great. So what you wrote about Sunday, now former Major League Baseball umpire Dale Scott, didn't realize, graduated from Sheldon the year before I graduated high school, back when we used abacus to do our math, spent 31 years as one of the men in blue. So he was asked to throw out the first pitch at a Dodger game on June 8th, but this was not a matter of a team bringing back an ump who was part of a unique or historical play. For openers, why was he there at Chavez Ravine 11 nights ago?
Well, June 8th was the Dodgers' LGBT night, and Dale Scott is the first openly gay umpire in Major League Baseball. He spent a lot of his career, he told me, trying to keep that under wraps. He didn't come out publicly until 2014. I think he just felt like it was time and felt like baseball had changed. So it's just interesting to see the evolution of, you know, in the beginning of his career, he told me he was horrified to think that anybody would find out about it. Maybe some of his close friends knew, and maybe Major League Baseball knew, but he felt like it would impact his ability to do his job if people knew about it. But now, since he's retired, he's had the opportunity to go around to several different places. He's going to be in Baltimore later this month, throwing out a first pitch for their Pride Night. So it's been a different, I think, a different reaction than what he imagined for a lot of his career.
Yeah, I feel like at this point we don't have to ask why he kept it a secret. While we have evolved a little bit, we still have a bunch of ignorant knuckle draggers out there. And so it was safe to say he was pleasantly surprised with how his coming out was received among his peers.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's one of those things that to each his own. And there's a lot of different perspectives on that out there. But, I do think that he was pleasantly surprised. And, the way he described it was, look, he's not trying to shove it in anybody's face. Some people just don't really have an interest in that subject, and that's fine with him. I think his perspective on it was just, hey, this is who I am. This is who I've been my whole life, my whole time as an umpire. If you knew me before, this shouldn't change a whole lot of how you felt about me, because it's just who I am. And I think one of the things that was really gratifying to him was after this became public, he said he heard from a lot of people, including a lot of umpires who were coming up through the system, in the minor leagues, or maybe just aspired to be Major League umpires, and their messages to him were, I was afraid that I would not be able to do this at the highest level, that this would hold me back. And seeing your story has helped me understand that I can do this. So I think that was really gratifying to him.
Yeah, a final thought on Mr. Scott, different angle, and probably something most don't even think of. I know I didn't. I assume a guy makes the major leagues as an umpire. He's there for good. He's earned his stripes. But contrary to that, after his first year, from what you wrote, he was apparently in danger of losing his MLB gig. I mean, what were his struggles, and I guess how did he overcome them to have a three-decade career?
Yeah, he was pretty candid about the fact that early on in his career, he was kind of in over his head. It's different now than it was at the time that he came up. He told me that now umpires, when they get a full-time promotion to MLB, they will have worked hundreds of games. It's just a fill-in, going back and forth between the major leagues and AAA. But he said for him, he'd only worked one game in the American League when he got a contract to work full-time. Back in 1986, he said he was only 26 years old and just wasn't ready. He said he sort of survived his first year, and then by his second year, players and managers had kind of figured out that he was lacking confidence. There were some mechanical, technical adjustments that he needed to make, and the supervisor of umpires at the time basically called him in and said, look, you're not cutting it right now, and we want you to succeed, and we want to help you, but if it doesn't get better, you're not going to have a job anymore. And that was really a wake-up call for him, and he spent the next offseason really working on his craft and made some changes and came back and ended up having a really long career as a major league umpire.
Yeah, it was a great story. I know you always look for the unique angle, and you done found it. talking with Austin Mika, the Register Guard. I always say that I'm a bigger fan of the sport than I am of my teams, be it the Yankees or Ducks or Knicks. So for most of your time as a Royals fan, they've definitely been an also-ran, obviously, 2014, 2015, two World Series, one title. This season is a disaster. How much does that impact how you follow or enjoy a Major League Baseball season?
I'm impressed that you've even paid enough attention to know what's going on with the Royals, because I barely have.
They are
really hard to watch right now. I think we talked before the season about tanking, and I brought up the fact that some Royals fans were a little bit uneasy because the Royals hadn't fully embraced the tank. They've embraced it now. I don't know if they were trying to, but they are tanking as hard as anybody. I think they were 22-50 at last check, so I've moved on now to tracking the guys in the minor leagues and looking at, okay, who's the number one pick going to be in 2019? Those are the things that cross your mind when your team is 30 games under 500. It does for me. It certainly takes away some of the excitement from baseball season. When there's a race afoot, when your team is in it, then you're paying attention to what all the other teams are doing. You're looking at the deadline to say, who can we pick up? What do we need? But it's a different feeling when your team is this far out of it this early in the season. And a lot of fans, I think, probably are feeling that way, because when you look at Major League Baseball right now, there's a handful of contenders that look really good, and then there's a bunch of teams like the Royals who look really bad.
No, it's an interesting dynamic this season. I'm sure eventually some numbers will pop up. You'll be like, wow, first time since 19, and then I'll go off on one of my statistical anomalies. But the Seattle Mariners in our region, 20 games over 500, but the crazy stat is just plus 22 in run differential. Yeah. In comparison, the Astros are only two games better, but plus 158. I mean, Felix Hernandez has been awful, save a couple of recent outings. Robbie Cano suspended for PEDs. So what's your take on this team so far? And if, with some questions up and down the lineup and rotation, could they hang in, or are we doing the smoke and mirrors thing now?
Well, I'm sure the advanced statistics people will look at the Mariners and say, there's no way they can keep this up. You mentioned their run differential. That does not point to a team that should be 20 games over 500, but they are. And I'm of the opinion that, you look at those numbers and you say, what should a team be based on the numbers? And if you've got a team that's really overachieving, then you can say, okay, well, maybe this team is due to come back to earth a little bit. But you know what? I also feel like there are teams who have, just have something to them that allows them to win close games. And it's not a total anomaly. A team that wins a bunch of one-run games, they do it for a while. Maybe you can say they're getting lucky, but eventually you keep doing that, and it becomes clear, at least to me, that, okay, this team has something about it, something special. I'm not quite ready to go there yet with the Mariners. But, the thing is, they're 20 games over 500. They don't have to give any of those games back. Those are in the bank. So, whatever they do from here, they're in a really good position. Now, if they just play 500 ball the rest of the way, which is what their run differential says they should be, a little bit above 500, they do that, they're in the playoffs. And a lot of Mariners fans are really happy.
Oh, I just did the math. They play 500 ball. That's 91-71. Well done. Couple final thoughts for Austin Mika, the Register Guard. I know you're not what one would consider a golf aficionado, but we did have our Open. It's a major event during kind of a downtime for sports post-NBA playoffs, pre-football. And the most veteran high-profile player on tour, Phil Mickelson, had a mini meltdown on the 13th hole Saturday. What was your reaction when you saw something this odd happening in real time?
Well, I thought it was funny. I laughed the first time I saw it. And I know that that was not everybody's reaction. I know that there are some hardcore golf fans who felt like he was disrespecting the game, that he should have been disqualified from the tournament and all that. Look, I want you to know, anybody who responded that way, you are the reason why the rest of us can't really get into golf. That, you know, just that level of sanctimony over something as silly as a guy hitting his ball while it was moving. I mean, look, was it a dumb thing to do? Yeah, it was dumb. Was it a little bit childish? Absolutely. Phil Mickelson wasn't going to win the tournament. I assume that he wanted to make a little statement there. He did something kind of impulsive. I thought it was funny. I was not offended by it in the least. And the people who were offended by it, you know, just that's where golf gets that reputation, that it's a little bit stuffy. You know, they can't relax and laugh at themselves a little bit. So I applaud Phil Mickelson to bringing a little bit of levity to the game of golf, which desperately needs it.
So you're saying those of us could be a little snooty, etiquette-obsessed, and self-important? Is that what you're trying to say?
I didn't say that, but but if you're saying that, I won't disagree with
you. All right. And lastly, the NBA draft is Thursday. So the second ever one-and-done duck, Troy Brown, and folks, don't rack your brains too much. I consider Willie Taggart the first. Considering that after they made the Final Four, there was a bunch of Oregon players drafted, and this young man is less accomplished. Austin, this is kind of a unique situation. So as far as where he might go, and what do you think of his potential as an NBA player?
Yeah, it's crazy to think of the Oregon players that are going to end up getting drafted the last 2 years. Troy Brown most likely will be the highest drafted player of any of them. Now, if you wanted me to lay down a bet on who's going to have the best NBA career, he would not be at the top of the list for me. Jordan Bell, Dylan Brooks, probably be one or two in some order. But I do think Troy Brown could end up having an NBA career. I think in the right situation, he could do well. And I fully admit that, you know, I don't study these things the way the NBA teams and scouts and the people who cover the draft do. So, you know, maybe there's something that the teams are seeing in Troy Brown that we did not see during his time at Oregon. You know, he's been described as a guy who can play the point, who can shoot three-pointers, and maybe that will end up being his role in the NBA. You know, he's versatile enough to handle the ball, to be a three-point shooter, but he wasn't those things at Oregon. You know, you look at his turnover numbers, his three-point shooting percentage at Oregon, he didn't really do that in his one season here. But as always, the draft is all about potential.
Yep.
You know, he's got the length, he's got the tools, so I'm sure that there, you know, if there's a team that takes him in the lottery, they will be seeing something beyond just what he did as a college player. But, you know, if you're asking me to put my money on it, you know, I watched Dylan Brooks for 3 years, I watched Jordan Bell for 3 years. I would put my money on those guys, even though they weren't drafted as high, having the better NBA careers in the long run.
Yeah, this is going to be really curious to follow. Whoever picks him is thinking more of 2020 and on. He is Austin Meek of the Register Guard, online registerguard.com, on Twitter at Austin Meek, RG. Austin, always a pleasure. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch up next Tuesday.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Take it easy.